All right, Zechariah chapter 11 tonight. Zechariah chapter 11. We're going to finish it off. We stopped last week in verse 9 of chapter 11. We're going to pick it up tonight in verse 10. Just to let you know, I'm going to finish off Zechariah before we start our kind of new format every other Wednesday night. We'll finish off Zechariah, then we'll kind of get into our format of more Sunday school type every other Wednesday night. But I'll talk more about that later. But we're going to finish the book of Zechariah in the next few weeks. Finish chapter 11 tonight. 12 should, should take 1 week. Same with 13 and 14. Again, should is the operative word because you know your preacher. All right, let's start with a little comic relief. Nothing incredibly funny, but this was a headline I saw recently. Rain creates wet roads. Startling information right there. Y'all all get that? Or rain? All right, how about this one? Pizza Hut. We have pizza. These are what we call obvious things in the world, right? Rain creating wet roads and Pizza Hut having pizza, which I guess is probably maybe new because maybe sometimes Pizza Hut doesn't have pizza. I don't know. I do struggle with the obvious at times. I think my family would say, and I'm glad Allie's not here tonight because she would affirm, I miss the obvious a lot of times. That's just me. Things that are obvious to everybody else, I overlook them. Now, I give you that to say this. We're looking at the book of Zechariah, a book written in the 500s B.C., a book that concentrated on the future of Israel, though there were some present realities coming to Israel in 520 B.C., but a book that looked toward the future of the nation, but more than anything, painted really an obvious picture of Israel's true king. Zechariah spoke and taught and preached the first six chapters really about the nation, the future of the nation. There were some present realities in these opening chapters. And there's some present realities as well toward the end. But when we get toward the end of the book of Zechariah, it's really making a grand picture of Israel's Messiah. It's not the only place, obviously, that Jesus is prophesied about in the Old Testament. But Zechariah really adds to the obvious nature of who Israel's king is. This king that they should be looking for, this king that's going to right all their wrongs. This king that's going to lead them out of trouble that they were in 520 B.C. And again, Zechariah just kind of helps us understand a better picture of who Christ is. Now, understand, and I think you do, we get information about Jesus from other Old Testament books. He will be born in Bethlehem. He will be born to a virgin. He will be a descendant of Abraham and David. And even Zechariah, in Zechariah 9, gives us a very specific insight into Christ. He will come riding on a donkey. And so the book of Zechariah, though previewing the future of Israel as a nation, is still future to us today, also previewed Christ, who would arrive on the scene around 26 AD, would present himself to Israel. Zechariah gave Israel a lot of clues of who to look for in their king, but Israel missed the obvious. They missed the obvious. And to say that Israel missed the obvious is really an understatement. They completely ignored the obvious. They just turned their head away from about 300 prophecies in the Old Testament that were fulfilled in Jesus' first coming. Israel just totally missed. Now again, some in Israel were saved. We'll talk about them tonight again. We saw them last week in Zechariah 11. The afflicted of the flock, those Jews did come to Christ, but they were small in number. But for the majority of Israel, they missed Christ. But it gets a little bit worse. Not only did they miss their king, not only did they miss their true shepherd, they followed false shepherds. In fact, if you look at the time of Christ, we're in the, you know, in the Gospel of Luke on Sunday mornings. Instead of following Christ as their one true shepherd, Israel followed their religious leaders, the Pharisees, the Sadducees, the high priest, the scribes. Israel, instead of coming to Christ, seeing Him for who He was, they settled for something much lesser. And again, that was already true in the book of Zechariah, even prior to the book of Zechariah. This comes after Israel's been in captivity in Babylon, and the reason they went into captivity is because Israel didn't follow their true prophets. God sent them true prophets, and who did Israel listen to? The false prophets, the false shepherds. And even today, if we look at Israel today, right, they're still following rabbis today. Rabbis who are not leading them to Christ as Messiah, but continue to lead them away from Christ. You could say the story of Israel, really in the Bible, the story of Israel is the story of a flock of people who can never find their rightful shepherd. It's really the story of Israel in the Old Testament and in the New Testament, that they're a group of people, a flock of people who can't find their right shepherd, and to make matters worse, they follow the wrong shepherds time and time and time again. Now, when we come back to Zechariah 11, we're really in a section that begins kind of in chapter 9. If you look back at Zechariah chapter 9, wait a minute, maybe, I'm sorry. Yeah, Zechariah chapter 10, really begins in the first part of chapter 10. Look at verse 3 of Zechariah 10. The Lord says, "My anger burns against the shepherds," speaking of the leaders of Israel, "and I will visit punishment upon the male goats, for Yahweh has visited his flock, the house of Judah." In other words, Israel had followed false shepherds, had listened to false shepherds, and because of that, God's anger burned against the false shepherds. And so what we get in chapter 10 and chapter 11 is really a comparison between the wrong shepherds of Israel, and then last week we began to look at the true shepherd of Israel. That really begins in verse 4 of Zechariah 10. We get a description of Christ, the cornerstone, the tent peg, the bow of battle, the good taskmaster. The good shepherd of Israel will make them into a mighty nation. They will trample their enemies in the street. Their nation will be blessed. They will be called back to their land. And verse 12 says, "And God will make them mighty." When they find their true shepherd, when they identify their rightful shepherd, there will be blessing for Israel. But we began chapter 11 last week and realized before they find their right shepherd, they're going to suffer for following the wrong shepherds. In fact, they're going to suffer mainly for their rejection of the shepherd when he first came to them. And so in chapter 11, we saw last week really a description of Israel's overthrow in 70 AD. The Romans came in. God punished the nation of Israel because they rejected Christ. And the Romans marched north from Lebanon all the way down through Bashan, all the way to the jungles of Jordan. They burned everything in their path. The Romans eventually ended up in Jerusalem. They surrounded Jerusalem. And they eventually burned the temple in 70 AD. And so we began looking at the price for following wrong shepherds last week. The price that Israel paid dearly for in 70 AD. In fact, in 70 AD, their way of life ended. They haven't offered another sacrifice in their temple since that year. Now again, they're back in their land today, but the temple's still in ruins. And so Israel paid a high price for rejecting their true shepherd when he came. And Zechariah is reminding them that it's, in a sense, you followed false shepherds. They left you in the captivity. You're now back in your land. You're not wanting to obey your God. You're not wanting to rebuild your temple. And if you don't get things right, there's going to be further consequences for not following the one true shepherd that the Lord is going to send to you. And so, to put ourselves back in the book of Zechariah, again, it's written around 520 BC. That's when Zechariah arrives on the scene. He preaches to the people. He follows Haggai, another prophet of God, who really came to Israel after they got back into the land. It says, rebuild the temple. Haggai gave them kind of a snapshot of what their life and nation would be like. And Zechariah paints a fuller picture. Zechariah says, your nation will be great. And once your king comes, once your true shepherd comes, God will bless you. And we've been looking really at this book, looking back now as believers in the church and recognizing the clarity of what Zechariah wrote about the coming king, but also marveling at the blindness of Israel. They were a nation that truly missed the obvious. Now, as we return to chapter 11 tonight, we've been dealing with the true shepherd. Again, the end of chapter 10 talks about the true shepherd, the blessing of the true shepherd. And then in chapter 11, we see the consequences for not following the true shepherd when he first came. And we begin a section really in verse 4 where Zechariah the prophet is kind of playing a role. In fact, the Lord says to Zechariah, shepherd the flock doomed to slaughter. In other words, Zechariah began last week to play the role of the good shepherd. And as Jesus came into the world in 26 AD, when he presented himself to Israel, He intended to shepherd the flock of Israel, but they resisted. And when they resisted, what verse 4 says becomes true. Christ shepherded a flock that was doomed to slaughter. In fact, the Jews that rejected Christ, they lived long enough to see their entire way of life destroyed 40 years later in 70 AD. Jesus was crucified in 30 AD, and then 40 years later, the Romans marched in. And so this was a flock that was doomed to slaughter, and Zechariah is playing the part of that good shepherd. And we follow that all the way down really to verse 9. And really verse 9 kind of becomes the summary verse of what happened to Israel. Verse 9 says, "Then I said, I will not shepherd you because they rejected Christ. What is to die, let it die. And what is to be annihilated, let it be annihilated. And let those who remain consume one another's flesh." And I reminded you last week that came exactly true. When the Romans surrounded Jerusalem, the Jews hid in the temple. They were starved out and they resorted to cannibalism. They resorted to eating one another's flesh. And that was really the consequence of not following their true shepherd. They came to a low point. I mean, the uncleanness of a Jew eating another Jew. I mean, that's the lowest of the low in terms of Old Testament law. But the consequences aren't quite done. I want you to look at verse 10 now. We're going to still pick up with this good shepherd. But again, these are consequences for Israel in 70 A.D., really when they rejected Christ in 30 A.D. and sent him to a cross. So look at verse 10 of Zechariah chapter 11. "And I took my staff, favor, and cut it into pieces to break my covenant which I had cut with all the peoples." Now again, this is the true shepherd speaking, right? And if you look back at verse 7, when the true shepherd came to Israel in 30 A.D. or 26 A.D., when he came on the scene, he came desiring to shepherd Israel with two staffs. He had two staffs, one he called favor and the one he called union. And we talked about them last week. In other words, when Jesus came to shepherd the flock, he came with equipment. And one staff was called favor and the other was called union. And the picture of favor, Christ came to Israel and he wanted to bless them. Remember in 26 AD, they were a nation that was under Roman rule. They didn't like the Romans. They despised their taxation. They despised their pagan lifestyle. And Christ came to Israel and he wanted to shepherd them with blessing. He wanted to protect them. He wanted to keep them from Roman oppression. He wanted to obviously bless them as his people. But when they rejected him, what did he do? He broke one staff. He broke the staff called favor. In other words, Christ said his protection of Israel was over when they rejected him. I want you to listen to Psalm 23. We don't think about Psalm 23 a lot in terms of Old Testament prophecy. But Psalm 23 verse 4 says this, "Even though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I fear no evil, for you are with me. Your rod and your staff, they comfort me." In other words, a staff was meant to comfort the flock. This was a staff that was meant to comfort the flock. Christ wanted to show favor to Israel. He wanted to show blessing to Israel. As Israel suffered under Roman oppression, Christ wanted to keep them safe. And yet when they rejected him, Christ broke his staff called favor. He really removed his protection of Israel. If you remember, one part of the Abrahamic covenant was what? God blesses the nations that bless Israel, and he curses the nations that curse Israel. But when Israel rejected their true shepherd, God's promise to curse the nations that cursed Israel was removed in a sense. He allowed the Romans to come in. When he broke that staff, the Romans were able to come in 40 years later. They were to come in and plunder Israel. And that's been true ever since. Israel has suffered under the onslaught of other nations over their years. Even today, right? There are still nations today wanting to wipe Israel off the map. In other words, when that staff of favor was broken, really the whole world was opened up to Jewish persecution. God cut his covenant that he made with the peoples. You see the word peoples right there in verse 10. This is really a covenant that God made with the nations. That's how you could also translate the word peoples. God made a covenant, a promise to the nations. They couldn't attack Israel without a cost, without consequences. And yet when Israel rejected him, Nations came in and still come in to Israel and plunder them and oppress them to this very day. Because when God removes his hand of blessing, removes his staff of favor, right, trouble ensues. And Israel has felt the trouble from all directions all throughout her history. And so that staff was broken and the Romans marched in. And look at verse 11. So it was broken on that day, and thus the afflicted of the flock who were watching me knew that it was the word of Yahweh. What verse 11 says is simply this. When the Romans marched in 70 AD and Jerusalem was destroyed, the temple was burned, the afflicted of the flock knew that God was behind it. Now again, who were the afflicted of the flock? The afflicted of the flock were those Jews who trusted in Christ. We kind of identified them last week. We identified them a little bit in the Gospel of Luke. The lame, the blind, the deaf, the prostitute, the tax collector. The afflicted of the flock were those who came to Christ, who understood Him as Messiah. Now in 70 AD, that flock had grown a little bit. But in 70 AD, the flock was mainly Jews who had come to Christ. And when these Jews watched the city of Jerusalem be destroyed by the Romans, when they watched the temple be burned, they knew that the Lord had allowed it. They knew it was God's doing. As verse 11 says, they were watching the burning of the city and they knew it was the word of Yahweh. In other words, God had removed His hand of protection. And these afflicted that were now known as Christians, they came to be known as Christians in the book of Acts. This is the church. The church in 70 AD recognized that the Lord was behind the overthrow of Israel. Now, before anybody thinks that this judgment was too harsh that the Lord inflicted, before we think that, you know, the cannibalism was so harsh, look at verse 12. We get a reminder from Zechariah of how harshly Israel treated their true Messiah. Verse 12, "And I said to them, if it is good in your sight, give me my wages, but if not, never mind. So they weighed out 30 shekels of silver as my wages. Then Yahweh said to me, throw it to the potter, that valuable price at which I was valued by them. So I took the 30 shekels of silver and threw them to the potter in the house of Yahweh." If those verses sound familiar, they should. Who fulfilled those verses? Judas, right? Judas betrayed Christ for 30 pieces of silver. And so the good shepherd, the true shepherd, says in verse 12 to Israel, if it's good now for me to be paid, right? I came to shepherd you. And what do you think my shepherding was worth? And what was Israel's response? It's worth about 30 shekels of silver. And what was that? The price of a common slave. In other words, Israel did not value their true shepherd at all. They saw him as nothing more than a common slave. Judas betrayed him for these 30 pieces of silver. And when Judas began to feel guilty about his betrayal of Christ, what did he do? He took those 30 shekels of silver and he threw it back to the religious leaders. And what did they say? Well, you know what? We appreciate the money, but we can't put it in the temple treasury because it's blood money. So what we'll do, we'll go out and buy a field that's called the Potter's Field, and it will serve as a cemetery for strangers. In that act in the New Testament, though Judas was unaware and the religious leaders were unaware, perfectly fulfilled what Zechariah wrote 500 years earlier. Again, no word of God goes unfulfilled. And we see this incredible prophecy that came to pass with incredible accuracy recorded in the Gospels, first written in Zechariah chapter 11. And that really kind of stands as a summary of how Israel viewed their Messiah, right? It's kind of some sarcasm right there. If it is good in your sight, give me my wages, but if not, never mind. And then Yahweh said to me, throw it to the potter, that valuable price at which I was valued by them. In other words, Israel saw Christ as nothing more than a common slave. And so Christ was betrayed. And that money was used to buy the potter's field. And then in verse 14, we get another consequence of Israel's rejection of their Messiah. Another staff is broken in verse 14. Look at it. Then I cut in pieces my second staff, union, to break the brotherhood between Judah and Israel. And so when Israel rejected Christ, he broke his staff of favor. He broke his staff of protection. But now he breaks the staff of unification. Christ wanted to come to the house of Israel. He wanted to unite them. They had been divided since 931 BC. They split into a northern kingdom of 10 tribes, a southern kingdom of 2 tribes. There had been civil war amongst the northern and southern kingdom. They had had two sets of kings. And Christ wanted to come and unite Israel. But when they rejected Him, their potential reunion was thwarted. He cut His staff of unity or union into pieces. The 10 tribes and the 2 tribes could have lived as 12 tribes under their Messiah, but they refused to come to Him. And they still remain a disjoined nation, right? The 10 tribes have never even been regathered in a sense. Though the 2 tribes came out of Babylonian captivity and came back into their land, the 10 tribes haven't really been regathered. So the prospect of regathering all 12 seems even more difficult when Christ broke His staff of unity. Listen to John 1:11. I love how John puts it, speaking of Christ in terms of His rejection. He came to what was His own, and those who were His own did not receive Him. That's exactly what the true shepherd of Israel felt in the first coming. He came to unify His people under His leadership, but they did not receive Him. And the end result has been, again, centuries of Jewish persecution. Other nations have persecuted them. In fact, Jews today, I think still today, I know it was true in the end of 2024, there's more Jews outside of the land of Israel than there are inside. I think it's like 8 million outside, 7 million inside. They continue to be scattered, even though there's been a regathering in 1948 of Jews going back to their land. There are still there's not a lot of unity in Israel even today. And so the consequences came after they rejected their true Messiah. But it gets a little bit worse. Not only did they feel the consequences of rejecting their Messiah in terms of their unity and their protection, Israel also felt the consequences of living under the leadership of a bunch of false prophets and false shepherds. Again, the Romans ruled them for a while. Other nations ruled over them. Again, they have just found no good leadership since they rejected their one true leader. Now, in verses 15 to 17, we move from the good shepherd, the true shepherd, to what we see as a foolish shepherd, spoken of in verse 15. Now, verses 15 to 17, Zechariah paints a picture of this false shepherd. We know him as Antichrist. Zechariah doesn't call him Antichrist here, but that's exactly who is being described in verses 15 to 17. It's not, though these verses could describe any false shepherd, we see some singularity here, right? Verse 15 speaks of a foolish shepherd, not shepherds. Again, verse 16 says, I will raise up a shepherd, singular. And so now we get a picture of the worst shepherd that Israel will ever have, the worst leader they will ever have, and this is still future to them. Though they have bad leaders and have had bad rulers and are under false rabbis to this day, there is coming one much worse. So let's read about him in verses 15 to 17, and we'll kind of go back and talk about him. Then Yahweh said to me, speaking to Zechariah, take again for yourself the equipment of a foolish shepherd. So in verse 4 and in verse 14, Zechariah played the good shepherd. Now in verse 15, he's going to play the bad shepherd. Take again the equipment for yourself of a foolish shepherd. Verse 16, for behold, I, this is the Lord speaking, am going to raise up a shepherd in the land who will not care for those who face annihilation, seek the young, heal the broken, or sustain the one standing, but will consume the flesh of the fat sheep and tear off their hoofs. Woe to the worthless shepherd who forsakes the flock. A sword will be on his arm and on his right eye. His arm will be totally dried up, and his right eye will be utterly dim. And so Zechariah now is going to play the part of a false shepherd, and really the part of the ultimate false shepherd of Israel. This is a picture of the worst leader that Israel will ever know. Now, the first mention of Antichrist is in the book of Daniel. Again, he's not called Antichrist in Daniel. It won't be through the New Testament that we get the term Antichrist. John will write, the spirit of Antichrist are in the world today. But this picture of this leader is really painted in the Old Testament, beginning in the book of Daniel. So I want you to turn to Daniel 7. Couldn't put it all on the screen. Put your bookmark in Zechariah 11. We'll come back momentarily. But Daniel 7 is where we first see the mention of this false shepherd of Israel. Now Daniel wrote his prophecy while in captivity, while in Babylonian captivity. Daniel was a young man in Babylon. He was faithful to the Lord. He didn't want Babylonian culture. He rejected it. He tried to stay true to his God. And because of that, God rewarded him. He was able to interpret dreams of Nebuchadnezzar. That's Daniel chapter 2. And in Daniel chapter 2, and Daniel's able to interpret a dream that really shows every kingdom of the world. In fact, I'm going to show you a statue. We'll leave that up here because we're going to read something that kind of corresponds to Daniel 2. But we're in Daniel 7. And so Daniel interprets a dream in Daniel 2 that's really a picture of all the kingdoms of the world. Y'all know the statue. Babylon's the top. The Medes and Persians. The chest of arms and silver. Belly and thighs of bronze is Greece. Then you get legs of iron. That's ancient Rome. That's the Rome that really existed from about 175 BC to about 475 BC. Now, a portion of Rome moved into the 1300s. But generally, that's the picture of the Roman Empire. And then there's a revived Roman Empire that I think is future to us, that clearly I think is future to us. And then there's also in Daniel 2, the rock out of heaven that crushes all the kingdoms and really crushes the statue. That's the rock of God's kingdom led by Christ. And so that's the dream that Daniel interpreted in Daniel 2. But in Daniel 7, we get really the same picture, but this time it's a series of animals representing the kingdom. I'll show you a series of animals. I drew that last night. Looks pretty good. No, I'm just playing. Stole that. But these are the animals you're about to read about in Daniel 7. Daniel, again, is in captivity with all his countrymen. They're in Babylon. They're wondering if their time is over. They're wondering if God's covenant with them is done. They're wondering a lot of things. And so Daniel is interpreting the dream in Daniel 2, and now he's given his own dream and vision in Daniel 7. And it's really meant to comfort Israel to say, look, it looks bad now. You're in Babylon. You're out of your land. But one day your nation will be the greatest nation the world's ever seen. Your nation will come and really conquer all the nations of the world under the leadership of the King of Kings. So in Daniel 7, we get some more encouragement for Israel. I want you to look at verse 1. We won't spend a lot of time here, but just to remind you of what this passage is about, Daniel 7, verse 1. In the first year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon, Daniel saw a dream and visions in his head as he lay on his bed. Then he wrote the dream down and said the following summary of the matter. Daniel answered and said, I was looking in my vision by night, and behold, the four winds of heaven were stirring up the great sea. That's most likely the Mediterranean Sea. And four great beasts were coming up from the sea, different from one another. The first was like a lion and had wings of an eagle. I kept looking until its wings were plucked, and it was lifted from the ground and made to stand on 2 feet like a man, and a heart of man was given to it. That's Babylon. Verse 5, and behold, another beast, the second one in the likeness of a bear, and it was raised up on one side, and three ribs were in its mouth between its teeth, and thus they said to it, arise, devour much meat. That is Persia. Verse 6, after this I kept looking, and behold, another one like a leopard, which had on its back four wings of a bird. That beast also had four heads, and dominion was given to it. That's Greece under the leadership of Alexander the Great. Verse 7, after this, I kept looking in the night visions, and behold, a fourth beast, fearsome and terrifying and extraordinarily strong, and it had large iron teeth. It devoured and crushed and trampled down the remainder with its feet, and it was different from all the beasts that were before it, and it had 10 horns. And so you see this picture of these beasts, I'll go back, and it really follows along. These are animals, this is a statue, and so, you know, you got a picture of a lion, a bear, a leopard, right? It follows all the way down, even into ancient Rome. In ancient Rome, that first installment of that kingdom is just simply called a beast. We don't get a description. That's all you see right there in verse 7, a fourth beast, fearsome, terrifying, extraordinarily strong. I don't know what that is. It's like an angry rhinoceros on the end right there. But hey, it's something, you know. So there's a beast. And really, when Rome came into the world, it did devour all the other kingdoms. We know that. It began as a republic. It finished as an empire. And clearly, we see it march through Israel in 70 AD. But then at the very end of verse 7, we get a picture of that same beast, because remember, this will be a beast, but the same beast will be revived at the very end in a kingdom future to ours. And note what Daniel says in verse 7. That final form of that beast has 10 horns. Now again, this is affirmed in other passages in the book of Daniel. I won't take you to all of them. But what that final kingdom of the Roman Empire will be like, it will be a confederacy of 10 kings, 10 horns. Horns represent leadership and strength. And so when the Roman Empire is revived in a day future to us, which seems to be, again, really a revival of Europe, it will be under the leadership of 10 kings, 10 horns. All right, and up until this point in Daniel chapter 7, we haven't seen the Antichrist yet, but look at verse 8. While I was contemplating the horns, behold, another horn, a little horn, came up among them, among the 10. And 3 of the first horns were pulled out by the roots before it. And behold, this horn possessed eyes like the eyes of a man and a mouth speaking great boast. And so in this final kingdom of 10 horns, Daniel sees that vision in verse 7. But now in verse 8, there's another horn, an 11th horn, that kind of springs up. It's a small horn. It's an insignificant horn. I think the Hebrew word here speaks of tiny, maybe even inconspicuous. It's not a very noticeable horn, but that horn kind of comes among the 10 horns, and this is the horn that will become Antichrist. He will become the leader of this final revived Roman Empire. And I want you to note something about him I think that people don't understand about Antichrist. He doesn't appear on the scene as like this beast out of hell. He's just a leader of a nation. And he was kind of left out of the 10. Maybe he led a smaller European nation. Maybe he didn't make the cut for the 10. He's looked on the outside. He's just the 11th king. And so he doesn't have a say, but he rises. He rises amongst the ranks of the 10. Maybe he's like, you know, the 11th king. It's going to be a substitute if one king dies. We're not sure, but it just so happens, and I won't take you through it, but you see it right there again in verse 8. There's 10 horns, and what happens to 3 of them? They're pulled out by the roots. Now, some have suggested maybe Antichrist kills those 3. There's 10. Antichrist kills 3. I'm not convinced of that. Just on the language here, it could be. It seems violent, right? They're pulled out by the roots. Seems like violent. But it doesn't necessarily mean that Antichrist kills him. In fact, I don't think he would do that. As we'll see in a minute, he's a very wise man. He understands the times in which he lives. I don't think going and slaughtering 3 kings is going to gain him, you know, worldwide popularity. Maybe it will. Maybe he does slaughter them. But whatever happens, Antichrist seems to be responsible for their removal. And their removal from the 10 allows him to kind of find his way in out of the shadows. And again, we won't go through every passage in Daniel. But Daniel also writes, the rise of the Antichrist, when those 3 kings are removed, the Antichrist pretty much assumes power over all of them. He becomes the leader of this final revived Roman Empire. Now, people have asked, and again, I'm not here to solve all your problems, or mine either, why is there a need for Rome to be revived? And again, the theories are out there. Again, I'm just going to speak in generalities, but most people say maybe it's a global financial disaster, maybe it's a global natural disaster. Some have said maybe the rapture of the church. Maybe when believers disappear, maybe there's such chaos after that that, you know, there's a need for some sanity in the world, and so this revived Roman Empire kind of takes over world leadership. I think it could be any of those things, maybe a combination of all those things. All I know is that the Lord says there's going to be a revived Roman Empire, and I believe it, right? And it's going to be led by 10 kings, and the Antichrist will again clearly ascend to the ranks and lead this Roman Empire. And so we see this picture of Antichrist, and I want you to note what it says in verse 8. He is, this horn possessed eyes like the eyes of a man. 2 things to note. First of all, the Antichrist will appear like a regular person. In fact, that's how he'll get his start. He's not going to be this, you know, crazy beast that you see in this picture, right? He's not going to be that. I mean, he's going to have the eyes of a man. He'll have like a normal appearance of anybody else. But these are incredible eyes. In fact, eyes generally signify a picture of wisdom, intelligence. He's going to be a very bright guy. He's no dummy. He's very clever. He's very insightful. He will come with great wisdom. It won't be wisdom from God, but he will appear as a very wise man, a very insightful man. And so he looks like a normal person, but he's, again, just almost over-the-top intelligence. He knows how to work a room. He knows how to gauge a situation. Again, eyes kind of speak of that ability. And so he's brilliant intellectually. He's insightful. But guess what he'll also do? He'll let everybody know it. Right? You see at the very end of verse 8, this horn has a mouth speaking great boast. Now, boast, this picture here, it's just saying he has a mouth that speaks great things. Now, mouths that speak great things often do boast. I think there is arrogance tied to that, but he's just going to be a great orator. He's going to have a way with words. I mean, people will hang on his every word. I mean, he's going to say great things. But I do think, in fact, I think it's clear from the Hebrew here. In fact, one of my favorite Hebrew words is found right here. The word rob. That's the picture of speaking great things. They're the picture of pride and arrogance, but also he's mesmerizing. He's just got a good mouth. People listen to him. He's going to command attention and respect in every room he goes in. Now, I want to say something here, so, you know, take it or leave it. It's interesting to me, and to be clear before y'all throw tomatoes, I voted for Trump, and I appreciate his policies. But one thing that Trump has changed about world leadership is this. You know, world leaders in recent history, not always, have generally been reserved and kind of deflect attention. Not this guy, right? He loves to talk about himself. I mean, he'll tell you in a heartbeat anything you want to hear. He's really kind of changing the way that leaders really react and reflect themselves in the world. I mean, he has no problem. I don't think Donald Trump's the Antichrist. Don't get me wrong. Bless. I'll get out of here tonight and I'll get texts. But no, that's not what I'm saying. But I'm saying, remember, as we move toward the end, there's going to be trends that we need to identify. And one trend, I think, that's really being kind of set on the world stage now is people not being humble anymore in terms of world leadership. They're brash. They're outspoken. I mean, it's not just Trump. I mean, Democrats and Republicans are now more brash than ever. And so it's kind of interesting to see when this guy comes on the scene, when Antichrist arrives on the scene, he's a great orator. He talks a big game. And I think the world will be prepared for that. They will want that. They will crave that. They will follow him. And so really what you see in Daniel 7 right there in verse 8 is really the first mention of this false shepherd that we read about in Zechariah 11. He's obscure at first. He's not easily identifiable. And in fact, you know, if you're around to identify Antichrist, you miss the rapture. So bad news for you, right? We're not trying to find this guy. We're going to be gone before he arrives on the scene. But he will rise out of obscurity, and he will eventually lead the world with his words. He will mesmerize them. Now, another thing I want to say that we can't look at in Daniel, what does Antichrist do when he rises to power? Like when he comes, you know, and rules over this 10-nation confederacy, first thing he does, one of the first things he does, is sign a peace treaty with Israel. Israel's going to be very nervous for some reason. They're nervous today, right? And one thing that Antichrist will do as he leads this 10-nation, 10-king confederacy is he will seek out Israel. And he will sign Daniel 9:27. You take a note, look it up. Daniel 9:27 says he will sign a peace treaty with Israel for 1 week. In other words, for 7 years. At the beginning of the tribulation period, in fact, what kicks off the tribulation period is when the ink dries on that treaty. Israel sits down at the table with Antichrist and signs a treaty. Now, just the statement of that is kind of shocking. I mean, Israel don't sit down with nobody. I mean, they're tiny, but they don't back down to nobody. But for some reason, when the tribulation begins, they're going to be nervous enough and trusting enough to sit down at a table and sign a deal with Antichrist. Now, again, he won't be called Antichrist, obviously. He'll have a name, but Israel will sit down with him and they will sign a treaty. And a part of that treaty will allow them to do what? Build their temple again. And because he signs and brings peace to Israel, and because he allows them to rebuild their temple, guess what Israel will do? They will line up under their worst false shepherd in history. For 3.5 years, they will be under his leadership. And he will bring a false peace into the world. Now, I think the Antichrist is identified in Scripture as a Gentile, but he will be the best Gentile friend the Jews have ever had. They will buy his lines, hook, line, and sinker. They will believe his words. Their temple will be redone, and they'll think their day has come. And yet, halfway through the 7-year period, their best friend becomes their worst persecutor. He turns on them. He goes into the temple. He tells everybody to worship him as God. He desecrates the temple they've built, and their best shepherd, they think, will turn out to be the shepherd that we see in Zechariah chapter 11. You can go back to chapter 11 now. We'll finish up here. I just got a few things I want to say about verses 15 to 17. So that's the picture of Antichrist rising on the scene, beginning the seven-year tribulation period, signing a peace treaty with Israel. They love him. In verse 15 and verse 16 kind of add to who he will be, right? You see in verse 15, he's called the foolish shepherd. That's the picture of ignorance. It's really the picture of evil as well. This will be a wicked shepherd. He will be kind of an ignorant sinner, if that's what you want to say in verse 15. He's an ignorant, sinning shepherd. In fact, the New Testament, what does it call Antichrist? A man of sin. His heart will be as black as any heart that's ever lived on earth. He will be a man of sin. You won't see that. He won't present that. That's who he will be. He will be a foolish shepherd. And note verse 16. This is a very interesting truth. Who is responsible for his rise in power? The Lord. The Lord will raise up a shepherd. Again, God doesn't sin. He tempts no one to sin. God does bring sinful nations and sinful people as judgment upon his people. So God allows the Antichrist to rise to a place of power and authority. And note what it says about this false shepherd, right? He looks like Israel's best friend at the beginning of the 7 years, but then he becomes someone who does not care for their annihilation. In other words, he becomes a persecutor of Israel, and he encourages other nations to gather and do the same. In fact, the world's largest army ever assembled will be assembled to wipe Israel off the map at the very end of those 7 years. And so the Antichrist described here doesn't care for those who have faced annihilation. He doesn't seek the young. That's a reference to young sheep, lambs. Lambs often get lost from the flock. They wander off. The shepherd always has to make sure they find their way back. But the Antichrist will have no concern for the young lambs of the flock of Israel. He will ignore them. He won't even help heal the injured of the flock, which refers to sheep who, you know, maybe having difficulties. We read about that in Psalm 23, right? The shepherd at times has to right the sheep, has to set the sheep upright that's fallen over. He has to restore the injured sheep. The Antichrist will have no concern for Israel in that regard, even though they think he's a good shepherd. But even the healthy of Israel, look at verse 16 again. He won't seek the young, heal the broken, or sustain the one standing. In other words, he won't even feed the healthy sheep. Now, this is the worst shepherd of all time in Israel. He won't help them in any way. And to make matters worse, he will consume the flesh of the fat sheep and tear off their hooves. In other words, instead of caring for the flock, laying his life down for the flock, he uses the flock to serve himself. He gets fat off the best sheep. He tears off the hooves. He doesn't care about their state. He's a violent shepherd. He's just the opposite of Christ. I mean, Christ is one who did what? You see, just the opposite. He sought the young, healed the broken, sustained the one standing. He didn't consume the flesh of the fat sheep or tear off their hooves. He cared for them, healed them, wanted to love them. But the false shepherd's just the opposite. Thankfully, the Lord will put an end to his reign of terror. Look at verse 17. Woe to the worthless shepherd who forsakes the flock. A sword will be on his arm and on his right eye. His arm will be totally dried up and his right eye will be utterly dimmed. The right arm is a symbol of strength, and the Antichrist will be the strongest of strong men. I mean, he will be the most powerful man the world has ever seen. He will have armies in the millions, if not billions. The eye is a symbol of a person's wisdom and intelligence, right? We already know he's going to be a very wise, intelligent, clever leader. But what will the Lord do to his arm and his eye? He'll thrust a sword in both of them. You can read about it in Revelation 19. And at that point, this selfish, egotistical shepherd of Israel will end his reign over them. He will start that reign in peace 7 years earlier. He will break that peace halfway through. And then his reign will come to an end at the very end of those 7 years. Let me just show you real quick, Revelation 19, 20, if you want to see it, to show you how well the Bible fits together. And the beast was seized, and with him the false prophet who did the signs in his presence, by which he deceived those who had received the mark of the beast and those who worshipped his image. So the Antichrist will have his right-hand man, the false prophet. He will lead the false religion of the world. The beast is the false shepherd. And then the last part of verse 20, these two, speaking of the beast, the Antichrist and the false prophet, these two were thrown alive into the lake of fire, which burns with brimstone. Who's the first member of the eternal lake of fire? The Antichrist and the false shepherd. They make it to the lake of fire before Satan himself. He won't go until the end of the millennial kingdom. And so we see the end of this false shepherd of Israel. He's cut off and cast off into an eternal lake of fire. Now, let's end with some good news, right? Kind of scary stuff there. Let me give you a couple thoughts to kind of end our night together. Number one, how do we react to all this? How do we react to all this? Number one, thank the Lord for rescuing us all from the false shepherds of our lives, right? Before Christ, we all followed a false shepherd. It may have been our own intelligence. It may have been our own wit, cleverness. It may have been our own false religion, or it may have been the false religion of somebody else. But before Christ, we all were under a false shepherd. Thank the Lord He opened our eyes to that. Which leads to number two. Thank the Lord for setting us under the one true shepherd of our souls. You read about this scary stuff, you don't have to worry about it. It's kind of intriguing to us. Daniel was intrigued. In fact, Daniel will go on to say in Daniel 7, he actually says, tell me a little bit more about this last horn. It's okay to be intrigued in a sense, but we're not fearful, we're not worried. The Lord rescues us from the wrath to come, a wrath that will begin with the Antichrist. So thank the Lord tonight for setting us under the one true shepherd of our souls. And I love how Peter says it. I think I did put it up here. Yeah, 1 Peter 2:25. For you, speaking to believers, were continually straying like sheep, but now you have returned to the shepherd and overseer of your souls. Praise the Lord for that.